I was stuck in traffic yesterday, and I was just staring at the chassis of this semi-truck next to me.
Yeah.
It was just this massive, gray, immovable slab of steel. And your brain just registers solid. It feels permanent. It feels simple.
It's the ultimate illusion of scale, because if you were to shrink down, way, way down, and walk across that surface with an electron microscope, simple is the absolute last word you'd use.
Oh, exactly. You wouldn't see a flat gray surface at all. You'd see this jagged landscape, a chaotic, complex world of crystals and layers and weird defects. Mm. And the kicker, the thing we were really digging into today, is that it is precisely those defects, the microscopic mistakes, that actually keep that truck from collapsing.
It's a bit poetic, isn't it? In most of life, we equate strength with purity. We want things to be perfect. But in metallurgy, and specifically in the physics of steel, perfection is weak. Pure iron is actually surprisingly soft. It's the messiness, the interruptions in that atomic lattice that gives steel its power.
So today, we are doing a deep dive into the absolute bedrock of modern infrastructure. We're unpacking the physics of strength in steel. We've got a stack of research here, specifically Measured Foundations of Scientific Progress, and a dense, fascinating chapter on strength from the text Perlite and Seals.
And this isn't just about saying, well, steel is strong. We're going to look at the recipe, you know, how you mix soft and hard ingredients to get something durable. We're going to look at a pretty heated mathematical battle over how to predict that strength.
Which actually gets into the philosophy of science.
It does, yeah.
And my personal favorite part, we're going to look at what happens when you push this material to its absolute breaking point. We're talking high velocity impacts, exploding plates, and heat that physically cannot escape fast enough.
It really is a journey from the atomic scale right up to catastrophic failure.
Let's start with the landscape. We're looking at this steel under the microscope. The text introduces two main characters right away, ferrite and perlite. But it makes a distinction. It says most structural steels are hypotectoid. Now, I know eutectoid is a specific composition point, but in plain English, what are we looking at here?
So the eutectoid point for steel is at about 0.8% carbon. If you have less carbon than that, which most structural steel does, you're hypoeutectoid. And all that really means is that when the metal cools down from being red hot, it doesn't transform all at once. It splits.
It separates into two distinct phases.
Exactly. First, you get proeutectoid ferrite. Think of this as the soft component. It's almost pure iron with very little carbon dissolved in it, and it forms first as the metal cools.
Okay, so that's our soft ductile matrix. And then whatever is left over transforms into the second character, perlite.
Right, but here's where it gets deceptive. If you look at it under a low-power microscope, perlite looks like a single grain, usually a dark, solid blob. But if you zoom in further, it's actually a composite structure itself. It's a layered sandwich.
Right, I was looking at the micrographs in the text. It looks like a fingerprint. Layer after layer.
It is. It's alternating layers of that soft ferrite and extremely hard cementite or iron carbide. So perlite is this beautiful laminate structure, soft, hard packed into a single grain.
So if we zoom back out, a piece of structural steel, it's basically a mixture. You have these grains of pure, soft ferrite, and mixed in among them are these nodules of perlite, which are essentially reinforced composites.
That's the landscape. Soft grains and reinforced layered grains.
Now, this brings us to the first big conflict in the text. How do we calculate the strength of this mixture? My intuition, and the text calls this the law of mixtures, says I should just take an average. You know, if it's 50% soft stuff and 50% hard stuff, the strength should be right in the middle.
That is equation 4.1 in our source material. It's the most common assumption engineers make because it feels logical. You sum up the strength of the parts based on their volume fraction, but the research shows it's actually wrong. It lacks what the text calls rigor.
Because the ingredients don't just sit next to each other, right? They interact.
Precisely. You have to consider the constraint effect. Mm. To visualize this, imagine you have a soft rubber band. That's your pure ferrite. Now imagine you glue some rigid plastic beads onto it. That's your perlite.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
If you try to stretch that rubber band, it can't stretch freely anymore. The rigid beads don't deform. They hold their shape. This forces the rubber right next to the beads to behave differently. It constrains the flow.
So the hard perlite is physically stopping the soft ferrite from moving the way it wants to. It's not just adding strength. It's changing the behavior of the soft stuff.
Exactly. And the text highlights a fascinating detail here about the timing of this. When you pull on this steel, the ferrite yields. It starts to stretch permanently way before the perlite does. The text mentions the ferrite starts moving at a plastic strain of just 0.002.
Which is tiny. That's barely anything.
It is. But at that moment, the perlite is still acting elastically. It's rigid. It hasn't started to flow yet.
So you have a material where one part is flowing like plastic and the neighbor is standing still like a rock. That sounds stressful.
It causes a strain discontinuity at the interface. The soft ferrite flows, hits the hard perlite nodule, and gets blocked. This blockage forces the ferrite to work harder, effectively making it stronger than it would be on its own. The average doesn't account for that struggle.
This actually explains something else the text mentioned, Luder's strain. When I first read that, it sounded like a medical condition. But looking at the graphs in figure 4.2, it's about the shape of the stress strain curve, isn't it?
It is. If you look at the curve for these mixtures, the start of the stretching isn't smooth. It's jagged. It's jerky. You see a yield point, then a drop, then this flat, bumpy plateau before it starts rising again.
And that bumpiness is the Luder's strain. I've seen videos of this where you can actually see bands of deformation shooting across the metal.
Right. It represents discontinuous yielding. It's the material struggling to figure out how to accommodate this mismatch. Those bands you mentioned are essentially the material trying to unlock itself section by section.
But, and here is where the text threw me a curveball. If you get rid of the free ferrite and just have a piece of 100% perlite, that jerkiness goes away. It yields smoothly.
Yes. Fully perlitic steel. Even though perlite is internally a mixture of soft and hard layers, as a bulk material, it acts unified.
Why? Why does the mixture of grains jerk and struggle, but the layered laminate flows smoothly?
It all comes down to the interfaces. In perlite, those layers of ferrite and cementite grew together simultaneously. Their atomic structures line up in a specific way. They're what we call semi-coherent.
Semi-coherent. So, atomically speaking, they're on speaking terms.
Right.
They fit together.
You could say that, yeah. Because they align well, these interfaces can act as dislocation sources. When you stress the material, these interfaces can pump out defects and dislocations smoothly. There's no sudden snap or struggle. It's a continuous flow.
Okay, so we've established that the layers in perlite are doing the heavy lifting. But this leads us to what I'm calling the math battle of the chapter. This seems to be the intellectual core of the text.
Oh, yes, the hall pitch debate.
So the central question is, how do we predict the strength of perlite based on how thin those layers are? We call that the interlamellar spacing, or SI.
It's a fundamental question. We know instinctively that thinner layers mean stronger steel. If you pack those hard cementite walls closer together, the soft ferrite has less room to move, so it gets stronger. The question is, what's the precise mathematical relationship?
And the text presents two contenders. In one corner, we have the inverse relationship, and in the other, the inverse square root, SI1.
And it sounds like academic hair splitting, I know. Does the exponent really matter? But the text makes a huge point of this. The exponent tells you the physics. If it's -1, it implies one thing. If it's -12, it implies a completely different pilot mechanism.
And the text points out that if you use the wrong formula, specifically that simple inverse relationship, you end up with results that are just unphysical.
Right. Some researchers tried to fit their data to the wrong curve, and when they did the math to extrapolate back, they calculated a negative friction stress.
Negative friction. So if I push the material, it pulls itself. That sounds like a perpetual motion machine.
Exactly. It implies the material has negative resistance to moving, which violates the laws of physics. It's impossible. But because they were just fitting a line to dots on a graph without thinking about the meaning, they missed it.
So how do they solve this? Because the text brings in a real heavy hitter here, Bayesian inference. Now, usually when I see statistics in metallurgy, it's just averages. This is different.
This is where the science gets really robust. The problem with the earlier experiments was overfitting. People took a small set of data points, drew a line that hit them all perfectly, and said, aha, that's the rule. But they were modeling the noise, not the actual law of nature.
They were seeing patterns where there were none because their data set was too small.
Precisely. Bayesian inference is a statistical method that essentially asks, given what we know about physics, which model is most likely to be true, regardless of the noise? It penalizes overly complex models that produce nonsense, like negative friction.
It's like a BS detector for data.
That's a great way to put it. And when they applied this Bayesian framework to a massive data set, the winner was clear. The classic Hall-Petsch relationship, the inverse square root, is the correct model.
So Hall-Petsch wins. But just when I thought I understood how barriers work, figure 4.11 came along. The text compares the strength of the ferrite inside the perlite layers to just regular, pure ferrite grains.
Ah, yes, the paradox.
And the pure ferrite is stronger.
Specifically, the grain boundaries in pure ferrite are a stronger barrier than the cementite walls in perlite.
That makes no sense to me. Perlite is this reinforced structure with hard ceramic walls. How can plain old grains of soft iron be better at stopping movement than hard walls of cementite?
It comes back to those interfaces we talked about. Remember, the layers in perlite are semi-coherent.
They're on speaking terms. They fit together well.
Right. That means it's actually relatively easy to get a dislocation to pop out of that interface or interact with it. It allows transmission. But in pure ferrite, the boundaries between grains are incoherent. They are messy, high-angle collisions between crystals.
They're not on speaking terms. They're yelling at each other.
Exactly. And those messy boundaries are effectively chaotic dead ends. The atomic mismatch is severe. They stop the dislocations dead in their tracks. So, counterintuitively, the chaos of the grain boundary is a tougher barrier than the orderly, hard wall of the perlite.
That is wild. It really challenges the idea that harder is better. Sometimes messier is better.
At the micro scale, yes. It forces us to rethink what a barrier actually is. Is it physical hardness or is it atomic mismatch?
Okay, let's zoom in even further.
Yeah.
We know the layers make it strong, but eventually everything breaks. How does perlite actually fail? Because there was another theory that Text spent some time debunking, the Langford model.
Right. Langford proposed a very brute force theory. He thought that when you stress perlite, the defects in the soft ferrite pile up against the hard cementite wall until, bam, they shear right through it, like a pile driver.
Seems plausible. If I push hard enough against a wall, I'll break it.
But the math just doesn't add up. The text runs the energy calculations. To shear through cementite like that, you would need a shear stress of about 1.7 GPa.
I'm guessing that's a lot.
It's massive. If Langford were right, perlite would be twice as strong as it actually is. His model overestimates the strength by a factor of 2.
So if we aren't punching through the walls, what are we doing?
We're flowing around them. Nature follows the path of least resistance. The cementite walls are effectively impenetrable at the start. The dislocations pile up in the ferrite, creating huge stress concentrations. But instead of snapping the cementite immediately, the ferrite flows in complex patterns between the walls.
Like water navigating a series of dams.
Exactly. Eventually, yes, the cementite will crack, but only after the ferrite has deformed significantly. It's a dance of accommodation, not brute force destruction.
That is a great image, a dance of accommodation. But now I want to stop being accommodating. I want to talk about extreme violence.
I had a feeling we were heading there.
The source material has a section on temperature and strain rate effects, basically. What happens when we freeze it and what happens when we hit it really, really fast.
Let's start with the cold. It's a general rule in metallurgy. As steel gets colder, it gets stronger.
Which feels wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I'd assume it gets brittle.
It does get brittle, meaning it breaks before it bends much. Mm-hmm. But the yield strength, the force required to start bending it, actually goes up. And this is due to friction stress.
This connects back to the lattice structure, right? The text mentioned screw dislocations.
Yes. In the body-centered cubic lattice of ferrite, the screw dislocations, a specific type of defect, have this complex 3D core structure. To move, they have to physically change shape. And thermal energy usually helps them do that.
Heat gives them the wiggle room to move.
Exactly. You take away the heat, and those screw dislocations get stuck. The friction stress skyrockets. You have to push much harder to make the metal deform.
Okay, so cold equals stuck dislocations equals stronger but brittle steel. Now let's go the other way. High speed, ballistics, explosions.
This is where we encounter adiabatic shear.
Adiabatic, that's a thermodynamics word. It means no heat transfer, right?
Correct. Hmm? Imagine you are machining a piece of steel or a bullet hits armor. The deformation happens incredibly fast. We're talking strain rates of 103.330 per second.
So fast that physics doesn't have time to catch up.
Specifically, the heat doesn't have time to move. Usually when you bend metal, it gets warm and that heat dissipates. But here, the event is so fast, the heat is trapped right where the bending is happening.
And heat softens metal.
Exactly. So you get this vicious cycle. You deform the metal, it gets hot, the heat can't escape, so that tiny spot gets softer. Because it's softer, all the deformation focuses right there, which makes it hotter, which makes it softer.
And you get a shear band.
A tiny line, maybe 10 to 100 micrometers wide, where the metal has effectively liquefied or transformed. In the micrographs, they call these white bands because they etch differently. The structure inside is pulverized.
It's basically a self-inflicted wound. The metal destroys itself because it can't shed the heat.
And these bands are dangerous. They act like pre-existing cracks. If you're building armor or a high-speed turbine, an adiabatic shear band is often the beginning of the end.
There was one other failure mode that really stuck with me because it felt like something out of a sci-fi movie. Spallation.
Ugh, the flyer plate experiments. This is fascinating physics because it treats solid steel like a liquid wave.
This is where they shoot a plate of material at a target to simulate an explosion, right?
Yes. A massive shockwave hits the front of the steel. It travels through the metal like a sound wave, but moving at supersonic speeds. It hits the back surface of the plate and reflects.
But it doesn't reflect as a push, it reflects as a pull.
Correct. A compressive wave reflects off a free surface as a tensile wave. So now you have this wave of immense pulling force traveling back into the metal, and if the timing is right, it meets the tail end of the original wave.
And the steel just opens up.
In the center. That's the scary part. The outside surfaces of the plate might look perfectly fine, but if you cut it open, the center is ripped apart. It's called spalling. It's like the steel exploded from the inside out.
The text mentions figure 4.25. You'd see these voids just opening up along the center plane. It's a reminder that wave physics applies to solid metal just as much as it applies to water.
And it highlights that strength isn't just about static loads. You can have the strongest steel in the world tested in a lab press, but if you hit it with a shock wave, the geometry of the wave reflection can tear it apart.
So we've covered the recipe, the math, the flow, and the explosion. When we step back and look at this deep dive, what's the synthesis here? What should we see now?
We should see a system. Strength isn't a single number. It's an interplay. It's about the spacing of those perlite layers. It's about the semi-coherent conversations between interfaces. And crucially, it's about how we model it.
The Bayesian part.
Yes. We learned that mathematical rigor is just as important as the physical testing. If we don't use the right statistical tools, we trick ourselves into seeing laws that don't exist, like that absurd negative friction stress.
And we learned that imperfection is key. The perlite works because the layers constrain each other. The pure ferrite is strong because its boundaries are messy and chaotic. If the steel were a perfect crystal, it wouldn't behave the way we need it to.
Absolutely. We engineer the defects to control the material.
I want to leave everyone with a thought based on that adiabatic shear we talked about. Mm-hmm. We spend so much time trying to make materials stronger, harder, tougher. But in that high-speed impact, the steel failed. Not because it was too weak, but because it was too isolated. It couldn't share the heat.
That's a profound point. The structural integrity became a liability because the laws of physics, specifically thermodynamics, wouldn't let the energy escape.
It makes you wonder, at what point does strength stop being about holding together and start being about how well you can let go of the energy that's trying to destroy you?
That is a question that goes way beyond metallurgy.
Something to chew on the next time you drive over a bridge. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the atomic lattice.
It was a pleasure.
See you next time.